When you look back over your life, it seems fast. Seems that things developed awful fast and you got old and quick. Although when you look at it carefully, it seems a long time too. Seems both. I grew up in an atmosphere of old-fashioned Methodists. You know what I mean by that? And they were a long ways from the God that I know. And I don't want to tell about it because this is all kindly. It must be kindly. It's no criticism of anybody. And as a matter of fact, I don't ever criticize anybody's religion. If he's got it, it's the best in the world. If he's got it. It's the best in the world, and you better work at it. That's what I told a Jewish girl once who came up to see me. They used to swamp me with visitors there at the Post Dispatch. You know, they'd read my daily column, and they thought I was knew more than I did. And the girl came in one day, and she wanted to show me her poetry. Well, it was during the time of flaming youth. You know, they were wild those days, too, you know, flaming youth. And this girl gave me her poetry to read, and I was in my office. She came in and asked if I would read her poetry and tell me what I thought of it. I read it a little bit, and I said, "Lady, I won't have to read this." I said, "I'll tell you what you do. You take this home, put it in a drawer someplace, and in 10 years you read it. Then you can criticize it, and you'll believe your criticism." I said, "Just 10 years. And I said, "But since you came here to see me, would you mind if I asked you a personal question?" She said, "I'd be glad if you did." And I said, "When you think about the world, doesn't it seem to be in a state of chaos, just flying around, nothing stands still? There's nothing that was true yesterday and was true today and will be true tomorrow." And she thought a little, she said, "Yes," she said, "there is." But I said, "What is it?" She said, "In my religion, I'm an Orthodox Jew." And I said, "Young lady, that's the best religion on earth. If you've got it, you go home and work at it." And that's the way I feel now about Methodist gods, although the Methodists have changed a lot. They're quite nice now. But I was a naughty boy because I didn't accept their teachings. I can't tell that, you know. But I do recite April theology and explain why I didn't want to be in church that morning. I was sitting out in a plum grove when the plum bloom was on, and the bumblebees were busy, and great white clouds were going over in the deep blue sky, and I had a sense of being lifted and glorified, and I wrote this as an expression of what I felt at the time. I didn't feel as I did because I had any disrespect for churches. But I was happy where I was and having a profound experience, and I didn't want to change. I wasn't staying away because I didn't like churches. I was staying away because I was having a wonderful experience. The weather was beautiful. Great white clouds going over in the deep blue sky, and the bees busy on the plum bloom. And I couldn't think of going inside. I was having a religious experience outdoors. And I was reading this, reciting this years ago at a sectarian school, college, and they're quite straight-laced. And when I got into the middle of it, I was struck with panic. I thought, what will these people be thinking of me? They'll think I'm a pagan, and that was a bad word in those days. And when I was through, I asked the audience, would you Would you object to a very young poet feeling that way on a wonderful morning in April? They all said no with one voice, and I've never had any trouble since. Oh, to be breathing and hearing and feeling and seeing. Oh, the ineffably glorious privilege of being. All of the world's lovely girlhood, unfleshed and made spirit, broods out in the sunlight this morning. I see it, I hear it. So read me no text, O my brothers, and preach me no creeds. I am busy beholding the glory of God in his deeds. See everywhere buds coming out, blossoms flaming, bees humming, glad athletic growers upreaching, things striving, becoming. Oh, I know in my heart, in the sun-quickened, blossoming soul of me, this something called self is a part, but the world is the whole of me. I am one with these growers, these singers, these earnest becomers, co-heirs of the summer to be, and past eons of summers. I kneel not nor grovel, no prayer with my lips shall I fashion, close knit in the fabric of things, fused with one common passion, to go on and become something greater. We growers are one, none more in the world than a bird, and none less than the sun, but all woven in to the glad indivisible scheme, God fashioning out in the finite a part of his dream. Out here where the world love is flowing, unfettered, unpriced, I feel all the depth of the man's soul and the girl heart of Christ. Mid this riot of pink and white flame, in this miracle weather, soul to soul, merged in one, God and I dream the vast dream together. We are one in the doing of things that are done and to be. I am part of my God as a raindrop is part of the sea. What? House me, my God, take me in where no blossoms are blowing, roof me in from the blue, wall me in from the green and the wonder of growing. Parcel out what is already mine like a vendor of staples. See, yonder my God burns revealed in the sap-drunken maples. I was always my own man, living my life in my world. But if my world was the whole world, because I wasn't limited to any one time. My grandfather and grandmother, my grandfather believed in the resurrection of the body. He said, the Bible says so. And I never questioned it because he's a good man. And anyway, I didn't know anything either. I was talking to a fundamentalist once, it reminds me. I don't know where we were, but we were together for a couple of hours. And he took most of the time to answer all the questions. He had the answer to all the questions. And when he was through, I said, yes, I don't know anything either. I always felt there's plenty of room for questioning. The person who was opposed to the fundamental religion wasn't in fashion. No, that it took more nerve to do it than I was always a little outside the mainstream, because the mainstream is always, you know what it always is. I used to hang out at the marble shop where they made tombstones. The proprietor was Professor Duren, and he was a rebel in every sense of the word. He liked me, and we used to cap verses on each other. We would be working in silence. I was rubbing marble, you know, polishing marble for him. And he knew Byron by heart, lots of it, and lots of Shakespeare. And we also had a friend, Judge Britton, who had been a very important man in law, but he had something had happened and he'd lost his fortune. And he was thinking of old times instead of the future, you know. But he was a man of great charm and great knowledge. He knew Shakespeare, much of it by heart, and he'd known the great actors and could recite as they did, you know. And so I had that sort of atmosphere. And when the atmosphere of the other kids was that of hogs and corn and just the everyday thing, you know, no thought of Shakespeare or... They were having a revival meeting, and we thought that was funny because this revivalist was posting about how God never allowed his tent to be destroyed by storm, by wind or rain or fire, because he was faithful to the Lord, you know. That was the old-fashioned religion, and our opposition to it wasn't popular. And we were considered, they thought it was spoiling me, you know, that poor little boy, and I was writing a book that's too deep for any of them. And it was all on the side of the angels, but they couldn't know that. And this evangelist boasted about how the Lord couldn't blow his tent down because he was faithful to the Lord, and he was really quite an ass. Well, we thought that was funny, and well, one evening the thing blew over. A great wind came, blew his tent down, and it caught fire. There was straw on the floor to keep people's feet warm. And there was a great fire and burned his tent. And I wrote what was, Judge Britton said, "Here's your chance, John." He said, "You'll write an Iliad about the, and call it the, we'll call it the Tentiad." And he said, "Think how wonderful it would be to have the forces of Reverend Cordner fight the devil on the plains of Nebraska, you know, just the same as it was in the Iliad." So they put me in the back room of the marble shop, and they kept me furnished with sandwiches and water and a little wine, and had me write the Tentiad. I wrote all day and most of the night and most of the forenoon, and it was all ready. And we had the Nebraska Democrat, which was in town, to publish it. The owner of the Nebraska Democrat was quite an outlaw. His opinions were all against the Orthodox, you know. And he printed the thing on the front page, two columns of it, bold as you please, you know. And it made it an awful stir in town. The preacher said that I ought to be run out of town, you know, for writing such a thing. It was really funny. We've been trying to find it. I was just a kid, you know, only 16. But it made a great stir in town. And the bad boys of the town made the most of it, and the good boys, you know, saw it viewed with alarm. But we have hunted for that Tentiad all over the state of Nebraska. We have hunted in the historical societies and here in Lincoln, and we can't find it. Any copies of it. Somebody destroyed it. But it really is funny. It was funny. It was see, I knew Homer pretty well. And I wrote this as Homer would do it, you know. The Iliad. It was the Tentiad, you see. Instead of the Iliad, it was the Tentiad. We had a great time with that. They said it would be the kind of thing that was done by Homer and Virgil and Milton. We were kidding, of course. No? Yes, I wrote the Divine Enchantment. You know, that I wrote a whole year, about nearly 2 years on that. It was to be my payment for the privilege of living in this world a little while. I had a feeling even when I was a kid, and I was some kid, I wasn't a sissy by any means. I lived in the world, you know, but there were two of me. One of me was doing the divine enchantment to pay for the privilege I've had in this world, the potatoes I've eaten, the roofs I've had over my head, and the other was for my own satisfaction. And I read it to John. John, you know, he thought he was witnessing the birth of a masterpiece. And we'd go out walking on the railroad or on the country roads, and I'd read the thing aloud, you know, and he'd listen. And he was happy about it, you know. He was all my audience. The Divine Enchantment sold, a single copy sold for $250 this last winter in Boston. Eastern philosophy, I was very much immersed in Vedanta philosophy and Hindu thought, Hindu religion. Even all my work has been notable for its mysticism. There's always been plenty of mysticism, although I've been a very great realist too. I believe in realism, but I think realism covers a wider scope than most people think. It covers metaphysics too. I got acquainted with the Upanishads, which are the cream of the Vedas, you know, the holy books of the Orient. I got the Upanishads from Professor Duren. I got a good deal of my real education through those men. They knew more than the schools knew and the colleges knew, the two of them. I've heard we had remarkable talk there in that Tombstone Factory. They were widely read men, and they'd give me books to read, you know. But I was already given to mysticism before I ever saw them. That's one thing that drew me to them. And I don't know what did it, except that it's just natural. I know there are things in the Song of the Messiah, which is a mystical poem, really. I didn't intend it to be necessarily that, but it is. And there are passages in there that are purely mystical. I was always aware of what I call the otherness of things, the other side of things.
You bid me go,
but which way lives the good? I know my friend would tell me if he could, where green's that land. What weary way to go, how many sleeps, and where the grasses grow the deepest and the water holes are sweet. Then I would ride my horses off their feet to find that country. But the spirit keeps the secret yet a while. How many sleeps? One sleep, the last and deepest of them all. I will not ride, my friends. Let them come and kill me if they want. Oh, God. James H. Cook, who was one of Crook's scouts, and his friend of mine, and he told me, talking about the Sioux, he knew them. They came to visit him after he... on his ranch, you know, they'd keep coming years after, you know, to their old men. And he said they deserved a better fate, for certainly they were brave men. My old brother friend died yesterday, Ben Black Elk, son of old Black Elk. He was the fellow who interpreted for me, and we're brother friends. He hugs me every time. He hugged me every time he sees me.
He wasn't a holy man, though. He was just a fellow. But he said, when you first came up there, he said, I was just a young Indian punk. I told him, oh no, we learned together, Ben. Yes, sir, Ben died, and here my little prize stallion died, but they were old. The stallion was 35 years old for a horse's age, and to a man's age, been 103 or 4. They live a long time on my farm.